Coming up on This Week in Enterprise Tech, hacks, vulnerabilities, all kinds of electronic mayhem, and why GDPR matters even if you've never heard of Europe.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 273, recorded January 12th, 2018. The EU cracks the GDPR whip.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started today at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, your place for all the best news in enterprise technology. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, back once again to the lineup here at TWiT and thrilled to be here. I'm joined by my favorite unindicted co-conspirators. First off, from the beautiful, warm Northwest U.S., Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, how are things up in the great Pacific Northwest?
It's doing great. You actually threw me for a loop there. When you said beautiful and warm, I thought, oh, he's going to go to Brian first. But it's actually grim and cloudy and rainy and cold here today. But it's I have a beautiful view of the pine forest here, so I'm doing great.
Well, a beautiful view from a heated interior is just the way to see the Northwest this time of year. Fortunately, in somewhat better climate, we have our other lineup regular here on TWiT from way out in Hawaii, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, how are things out in paradise today?
Well, I really and truly wish my fellow passengers on the flight home had not shared the creeping crud. My doctor was actually very afraid because, you know, they ask you that question, have you been outside the U.S.? And I said, yes, I have. And they're actually afraid that I had caught the H3N2. But happily, it was not. It was just a little viral infection, and I have managed to kick it and feeling much better in warm Hawaii. Because, man, when we left Orlando, it was down in the 30s.
And I wish I could tell you that Florida had warmed up a lot, warmed up a little bit, but tonight going back in the deep freeze. So I'm jealous of your weather. Well, we can all be jealous, but we've got a lot to talk about today. We've got a great episode with a really important guest coming on to talk about something that's been hanging around our friends in Europe for a while, but is getting ready to have an impact on U.S. IT shops in a big way. You're not going to want to miss that. But before we get there, let's go to some blips. First up, Cisco brings AI to more encrypted data. You know, you should be encrypting your data at rest and in motion, but encrypted data can also be a haven for malicious traffic. That's why Cisco's announcement that they have made encrypted traffic and analytics, that's ETA in Cisco speak, broadly available, and it could be a big deal for a lot of organizations. ETA began as a product for Cisco's big enterprise switches, but now it's available on switches designed for data centers, branch locations, and smaller companies. Now, ETA is a combination of local analysis engine and cloud-based platform that analyzes anonymized metadata collected using a modified version of NetFlow. Cisco uses a variety of machine learning and AI techniques to predict whether the data described by the metadata is legitimate. If it's not, traffic is flagged for deeper inspection and quite possibly denied transit across the flow. Now, if your organization is encrypting most of its data, it needs a way to analyze those flows for malicious content. Cisco's ETA could well point the way for a high-performance strategy to make CIOs, regulators, and auditors all happy about the way encryption is being done.
Well, in the midst of Meltdown and Spectre vulnerabilities, security researchers and hackers alike are doing their due diligence against common hardware to find more vulnerabilities. Well, a Finnish cybersecurity firm, F-Secure, is no exception to this rule. They reported on an unsafe and misleading default behavior within Intel Active Management Technology, or AMT, that could actually allow an attacker to bypass login processes and take complete control over a user's device in less than 30 seconds. AMT is mainly for organizations' admins to assist in remotely managing and repairing PCs, workstations. But how bad is this bug? Well, it's not great. The bug allows everyone to the bug actually allows anyone with physical access to the affected laptop to bypass the need to enter login credentials, including user, BIOS, and BitLocker passwords and TPM codes, enabling remote administration for post-exploitation. Normally, setting the BIOS password prevents an unauthorized user from booting the device or making any changes to the boot up process. With this vulnerability, it's pretty much no holds bar, meaning the password, unfortunately, doesn't prevent anybody from actually unauthorized access to the AMT BIOS extensions, which means it allows an attacker to access and configure AMT to make remote exploits possible. The concern are that it makes it easy to exploit this without a single line of code. It affects a ton of Intel corporate laptops, and it could actually enable attackers to gain remote access. So we're kind of in big trouble here. F-Secure has notified Intel and all relevant device manufacturers about the security issue and urged them to address it very quickly. What does this mean for your organization? Well, as we said in the past, it means holding back on device updates might not be the best in your interests. Service delivered patches might want to be on your list for your New Year's resolutions.
No. Mobile data is not a substitute for adequate broadband. While broadband consumer advocates have launched a mobile-only challenge to show U.S. regulators that cellular data should not be considered an adequate replacement for home internet service, the awareness campaign comes as the Federal Communications Commission is considering a change to the standard it uses to judge whether broadband is being deployed to all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion. While FCC Chairman Ajit Pai hasn't released his final plan yet, the FCC may soon declare that America's broadband deployment problem is solved as long as everyone has access to either fast home internet or cellular internet service with download speeds of at least 10 megabits per second. That would be a change from the current FCC policy, which says that everyone should have access to both mobile data and fast home internet services such as fiber or cable. My question is, do we as consumers consider cellular an adequate substitute for true broadband? I think not.
Are you ready to hire Alexa? At this week's CES in Las Vegas, HP, Acer, Asus, and Lenovo all showed new machines running Windows 10 and featuring Amazon's Alexa Virtual Assistant. The new machines aren't just consumer devices either. Alexa is now being touted as a feature on enterprise-ready computers. Of course, Cortana comes baked into Windows 10, but it's meaningful that Alexa is joining Microsoft's own virtual assistant on these business computers. This is a natural progression of Alexa into the business world following last year's introduction of Alexa for Business. Now, it remains to be seen how the combination of voice-based virtual assistants and open office plans will work out, but it's obvious that these virtual assistants are the latest background on which tech giants are going to fight, and that fight is coming to homes, autos, and yes, right into the office as well.
Surprise! Well, maybe not surprise, because we kind of knew this was the truth, but community broadband costs less to run and less for customers than the telecom accounts. Are you surprised? Well, a new study by Harvard makes it clear why incumbent ISPs like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T are so terrified by the idea of communities building their own broadband networks. In the 23 communities that were actually looked up, prices from the lowest cost service, meaning the FCC's definition of broadband, were between 2.9% and 50% less than the lowest cost such service offered by the private ISP in the market. As quoted, when considering entry-level broadband service, the least expensive plan that provides at least 25 up and I'm sorry, 25 down and 3 megs up. Service 23 out and 27 community owned providers we studied charge the lowest prices in their community when considering the annual average cost of a service over a 4-year period, taking into account installation costs and equipment costs and so on. If nothing else, this points out the competition will be forcing Function for better service and faster speeds and lower prices. Now we just need to convince the and educate communities that it's time to go to community-driven broadband.
Ford and Postmates want self-driving cars to deliver your next pizza or whatever. Sounds fun. Ford announced at CES the other day that it has entered a partnership with delivery service Postmates and will begin piloting various programs to see how self-driving vehicles and on-demand delivery can work together. Here's how I imagine this near future view to look. As I look back at ShotPut back in episode 255, and I could imagine these self-driving trucks rolling up and the ShotPut robot dropping bins of inventory on the sidewalk for automated restock. Fun.
Finally, is AR ready for business prime time? Well, we've been hearing about augmented reality for years, and it seems that each year the technology is almost ready. 2018's CES has brought us yet another verse of this song, but this one seems different, like the technology really is just about ready to take its place in the business world. As proof, the Vuzix Blade is a premium price product that features both solid AR capabilities and a look that doesn't scream geeky early adopter. When combined with voice-based virtual assistants, AR devices promise a new way of working with computing systems, and there are already killer apps for both blue and white-collar workers. The real question is just how long it will be before our offices are filled with employees wandering around, appearing for all the world like they're staring into space and talking to their imaginary playmates. So there are still social issues to be worked out, but the day when AR is a common way of experiencing the computing world just bladed a little bit closer. Well, that's it for the blips. We've got a lot more to come, but before we do, there's an ad and a chance to hear from Father Robert. Take it away, Father Robert.
We'll get right back to the action, but first let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week at Enterprise Tech. Now let me ask you a question. The last time you went in for a mortgage, was it fun? Was it enjoyable? Did you come out thinking, wow, that's an experience I want to do again? Oh, of course not, because it's horrible. See, the mortgage experience hasn't kept up. It's still based on you going into a bank and speaking to a complete stranger, maybe giving him or her a box of receipts and old pay stubs where they can then decide whether or not you are worthy of a loan. Well, folks, that's just ridiculous. That's the old way. What you need is a new mortgage experience. What you need is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, Quicken Loans understood that the mortgage experience wasn't keeping up. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. It was a dated experience. They wanted something that was client-focused, that took the technological revolution and gave you everything that entailed. Now, Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No more faded receipts. No more old pay stubs and pieces of paper. It's all digital. We live in a digital world. Why not be digital? It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And with those calculations, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get back to the action with the Twiat Riot.
Thanks, Padre. It's great to hear your voice and hear about that great sponsor. We've got a great guest coming up in just a few minutes. But before we get there, we do have a bite because we still have a critical set of security issues to talk about. Now, Meltdown Inspector, they're so last week. As it turns out, EMC and VMware want to get into the security oops action as well. Now, while everyone was screaming about Meltdown and Spectre, another urgent security fix was already in progress for many corporate data centers and cloud providers who use products from Dell's EMC and VMware units. A trio of critical, newly reported vulnerabilities in EMC and VMware backup and recovery tools, that's EMC Avamar, EMC Networker, EMC Integrated Data Protection Appliance, and vSphere Data Protection, could allow an attacker to gain root access to the systems or to specific files, or inject malicious files into the server's file system. These problems can only be fixed with upgrades. The first of the vulnerabilities, designated in MITRE's Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures, that's the CVE list, as CVE-2017-15548, allows an attacker to gain root access to the servers. This would potentially give someone direct access to backups on the server, allowing them to retrieve images of virtual machines, backed up databases, and other data stored within the affected systems. The second vulnerability, CVE-2017-15549, makes it possible for an attacker to potentially upload malicious files into any location of the server file system without authentication. The third, that's CVE-2017-15550, is a privilege escalation bug that could allow someone with low-level authenticated access to access files within the server. The attacker could do this by using a web request crafted to take advantage of path traversal, that's moving up and down within the directory structure of the file system used by the application. These attacks all require access to the network that the servers run on, so it may not be possible in most cases to execute the attacks from the internet, at least if the backup systems are running in a network partitioned from the internet. But in these vulnerabilities, you could create opportunities for attackers who've already managed to get a foothold in data centers via other exploits to take further advantage. And unfortunately, as security researcher Davi Ottenheimer pointed out, there are hundreds of these systems exposed to the internet, including more than 100 of them in Ukraine, China, and Russia. Now, I want to bring in my co-host on this. Chibert, the first thing we need to realize is that with these vulnerabilities, no passwords are required to access the backup data. Now, I have to ask, in your experience, are most people doing a good job of password protecting backup data, or is that in itself sort of a processed level vulnerability that exists in a lot of places?
I've seen way too many people not password protect backup data sets only because they're paranoid. You know, we've seen a lot of cases where, you know, tapes or whatever backup medium you use had a slight glitch. And with encrypted data or password protected data, sometimes you can't do a restore. Well, all too many people say, no, I don't want to take that chance. I'll just rely on physical security. So that's all nice. Now, I will need to point out, this requires that you be on the local network of the files of the servers. So if you are, sadly, making that management network available to the world, don't. Also, there's a lot of people freaking out about Meltdown and Spectre. Both require physical access. So to the other people, you know, in the mainstream media, chill, guys. Come on. This is not the end of the world. You have time, it requires physical access, or it requires access to the network. Just patch. Again, I think this is more a case of it's got a cool name and it rolls off the tongue, and mainstream media is saying, hey, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Absolutely, and let's never underestimate the importance of a really scary name when it comes to giving a vulnerability a lot of publicity. There's one other thing we want to make sure that we talk about, and Lou, I want to talk about this with you, because these systems use Apache Tomcat, And there are reports that these systems that were developed may not have kept up with all the Tomcat vulnerability patches and updates that could lead to vulnerabilities in the fully developed systems. Now, you work managing developers. When you're looking at systems that use a lot of other components, components that were developed by other people, what kind of practices are in place? I mean, is it a best practice to fully vet and patch all of the components that you're using, or do you tend to rely on the reputation of the people developing those other components and use that as a way to save time in your development process?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, there's a fine line between, hey, let's use some open source to get ahead in the game, to not have to write something and to share code, versus introducing something that might cause a vulnerability or not be just right for us. And there's a lot of times when you use open source libraries or application code from other teams, and you're going to have to do your own due diligence on that code to ensure that you don't have these issues. You know, there's a lot of times we'll pull stuff in and we'll run it through the gamut of testing. You know, we have what we call horizontals, where we say, hey, we do a set of security testing and performance testing and memory leak and resources and all this stuff to ensure that it's up to par with what we want. And then we also look at, anytime a new library comes out, let's say you're using open source 1.1 and 1.2 comes out, we always look at the code and what's different, what's changed. We run it through the gamut as well. We make a really conscious decision whether if it's a security patch they're fixing, whether we should take it or not, and how fast we should get it out. So there's just a lot of things to think about. And when organizations are having to think about that stuff, they tend to forget some of the kind of the areas and the avenues there. So and the perfect example is forgetting to patch things because they don't want to potentially cause compatibility issues with their devices or their servers or so on. So they tend to kind of only roll patches out every so often. We have lots of times problems here even internally where we have compatibility with some of the newer stuff, which is why we do automation on all of our software. We say, hey, if we're using, let's say, Outlook on a machine and we want to make sure it works on the newest version of Windows, we always have an automation machine running Outlook on the newest version or the latest version or the previous versions to make sure that compatibility works. And a lot of these organizations have to start doing that to kind of cut their costs down when they get hacked because they're not up on the patches. So I think more organizations have to start doing that.
No, I think you're right. There are a lot of organizations that need to fine-tune their development to find a better balance between speed to deployment and code quality and security. Well, there's a lot to talk about with these vulnerabilities, especially since, as we know, these are probably the very last software vulnerabilities we'll hear about this year. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about this more, but we're going to turn now to an issue that is going to affect an awful lot of people. It's not a vulnerability, but it could have some huge consequences if they don't treat it seriously, and that is GDPR. Now, our guest talking about GDPR is Darren Ray, who is the CEO of Fifth Step. Darren is a data privacy expert who's been involved with EU data protection since the late 80s as a programmer, all the way through to today when he's advising companies around the world on how to implement data privacy in such a way as to maximize the reuse of controls and proofs that have already been implemented to meet other requirements. Back to that reuse issue that Lou and I were just discussing. Now, the introduction of the new EU regulation, GDPR, is going to change the way that data is collected, stored, reported, and accessed all around the world. For those based in Europe or who are processing personal data belonging to EU residents, they're going to have to implement all the GDPR protections or run the risk of large fines. Now, Darren wrote a book on GDPR called The Little Book of GDPR, Getting on the Path to Compliance. And as we all know, virtually all of GDPR comes back to IT to implement and make it real, especially make it real in a way that auditors and compliance officers are willing to accept. A big part of GDPR is privacy by design. So it doesn't work as well with this concept that so many organizations have in place of building a system with no regard to security and then patching security as an overlay or a group of add-ons. Requires IT teams to understand at least the basics if they're going to successfully build and deploy systems. And they don't have a lot of time. May 25th, 2018 is the implementation date. Now, we're going to talk to Darren. And first, let's introduce him. Darren, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Kurt. Good to see you.
It is great to see you. And I want to start with a question. Now, GDPR, we're talking about it as something new, but it's not really. The idea of data privacy and protection has been around in the UK since 84, the EU since 98. Why are we talking about GDPR in such serious terms now?
That's a really good question, and one that many people ask me as one of the first questions, particularly those in the US or haven't been exposed to European data protection before. And the real answer is that the GDPR changes the rules. Up until now, most countries have implemented data protection on the basis of it's something that we need to do within our country or within our region. GDPR changes that. And it says that if you're processing the data, the personal data of European residents, then you have to abide by the rules. And if you don't, then you're going to be open to fines. And those fines can be large and scary. And I'm not one of these guys who talks about fines and tries to scare people into implementation. That's not what I'm about at all. But the fines are large and they are making people sit up and take notice. So the fines can be as high as 20 million euros, which is about $24 million at current exchange rates, or 4% of annual global revenue, whichever is the larger of the two. So you've got organizations like Facebook and Google, for example, who are taking a great deal of notice about GDPR. And certainly in Europe, I've seen the way that organizations like Google have changed their messaging, and they're now constantly checking that they've got permission to use my data, reminding me that they're using my data, and some of that data might be personal data. So it's a real change in the whole tone of how data protection is being implemented around the world. And the key aspect there is that means you have to implement if you're in the US as well. Many people ask me to double check that, so they really understand. But if you're processing the data, the personal data that belongs to European residents, you've got to implement in the US too.
So let me be clear on a couple of things. If you are someone, even a smaller organization that is doing sales on the internet, if you have even one or two customers who are in Europe, then you fall under the rules within GDPR. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, it is. Now, there are some gray areas still within GDPR, and that sounds like a strange thing to say with it's about to be implemented. But all of the regulators have been very cagey on where the boundary lies between, the number of employees you have to have or the number of European residents' data that you have to be holding before you become liable to implement these or liable for fines if you're actually breach. If you've got one or two, I think you're probably going to be on the safe side. But for the enterprise, the larger enterprises where you've got staff in Europe or you're processing data as a matter of course of your business, then you're definitely going to have to implement.
Okay, well, it sounds like this is the sort of thing where getting some of the gray out and firming up those lines is a process that will involve attorneys at some point. So we'll wait until the legal fees have all been paid before we speak finally on that. But I'd love to get a little bit into GDPR and what it is, because the language can be confusing. For example, it seems like there's a difference between personal data and personal sensitive data. Can you walk us through some of these key terms that we might be hearing about GDPR and what they actually mean?
Sure. In fact, we've got a slide that if we can pop slide number two, it gives some of the terms there. But I'll walk you through some of the key pieces there. So personal data. Personal data is similar in definition to PII, really, but it's really anything that can identify a person, an individual. So that can be a bank account number, because that comes down to an individual. A credit card number can identify an individual. And here's the one for the Twyatt audience. IP addresses, those IP addresses that get logged by your web server, they are considered to be personal information. Okay, so the extent is quite large in the way that personal information is defined. So it's not just name and email address or the obvious ones like that. It's it can include include cookies and other identifiers. Personal sensitive data, that's personal data that's a higher grade. The way I think of this is it's typically the things that people have been persecuted for in the past, and perhaps in some countries still are. So you've got things like racial or ethnic origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, trade union membership, genetic data, biometric data. They perhaps fall outside of that initial definition I gave, but also sexual orientation and the sex life of an individual is considered to be personal sensitive information. So you have to treat that information with greater care and make sure there is a real defined need for capturing that information. And, you know, a key aspect here is the next, that yellow box there on the screen is consent, making sure that an individual gives absolute consent to the use of their data and that they understand what the data is going to be used for. So it needs to be 100% informed consent. You can't just say, oh, we're going to take your data and we're going to use it for one thing and then use it for a marketing campaign and then use it for a cross-sell campaign and then use it for something else. You've got to be very clear about what you're using it for. And it can be more than one purpose, but you need to be clear about what you're using it for right from the outset. I mentioned the purpose. That's very, very important. A purpose or purposes, get those out in front, and they have to be clearly displayed to any data subject, any person giving consent for their data to be used. They have to be clearly displayed before that person gives consent. Data controller, let's talk about those. The data controller is the organization or person persons or organization who define the need and purpose for collection of the data. And then you have a data processor. That's the person who processes the data. So that is typically a third party. So if you have an organization that's hosting your data, then that company would be considered a data processor under the terms of GDPR.
Can I ask a quick question on that data processor and the third parties? One of the things that we see, especially in a lot of cloud applications, is that there can be many, many different layers. I mean, you talk about third parties. You can have fourth, fifth, sixth parties quite easily. So if I'm the organization that has the customer-facing website, say, that's how I'm gathering this information, how deeply does my responsibility and does my liability extend through the chain? Am I responsible for what that fourth or fifth or sixth level contractor might be doing with the data?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. Okay, the more detailed answer is there can be multiple data controllers. So as the layers go down, there may be multiple data controllers. But the simple answer is yes. If you are collecting the data and you're defining the need for the collection of that data, your liability goes all the way to the end. So you have to make sure that your vendors are able to adhere to the standards and are going to only use the data for the purpose it was collected, that they're going to keep it safe and secure and encrypted as appropriate or protected in whichever way is appropriate for your data, all the way down through the chain. And that's another big change around GDPR from the previous incarnations of European data protection, is that the liability remains with the data controller.
Very good. And that can be a significant liability indeed. Well, we're going to have more questions. And I know that my my colleagues here are eager to talk with you. But before bring them in, I want to get with you about one of these other issues. And that is the concept of privacy by design. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious about why this is so important. I know that there are some organizations who would basically say that they've been quite successful in providing privacy as an afterthought, although they wouldn't phrase it exactly that way. It's precisely what they mean, that privacy is something that they've sort of bolted on to existing systems. What about GDPR changes that equation and makes designing privacy into the process so important?
I guess it's really about starting with the end in mind. If you're going to design something and you have a fairly good idea of what it's going to look like and what you need to protect it against and how it's going to be used. Now, no one's saying that can't change or develop or evolve. But if you start off from a sound base of implementing privacy by design, thinking about how the data is going to be used, how it's going to be disposed of, how you're going to limit access to only those who should have access to it, those kind of things. And you're starting with that from the outset. You're likely to end up with a far better solution than coming along and bolting things in after the event. You know, we've all seen solutions that have perhaps suffered, as you said earlier on, from that. Bolt it on afterwards and I'm sure it'll work. And that leaves vulnerabilities. And some of those vulnerabilities we're reading about being exploited all of the time, some going back, tens of years now before they're exposed. So implementing privacy by design means that you're thinking about it from the outset. You're considering how strongly the data needs to be protected, the type of data that you're protecting, and what the best practices is, what the best practices are. And then you're reviewing that. You're making sure that you're keeping that up and thinking about that with every iteration, every update of the system. You're keeping that in mind with the next update and the next patch. Are we still at the right place on this? Are we still where we think we are, or as protected as we are? And learning the lessons. If there are breaches, if there are hacks, if there are bugs, then you're learning those lessons and you're patching those and you're building those into your forward thinking for the next version of the system or another system that's going to be designed by the same team.
Well, the discussion on design is, I think, a critical one. And to take us deeper into that, I'd like to bring in my colleague, Lou Maresca. Lou, I know you have some questions in some very particular areas for Darren.
Yeah, so I think, a lot of software companies, they're taking, obviously, GDPR pretty, pretty seriously, especially if they're international corporations. And one thing they're noting is, hey, how do we have all these different areas, places where we store data? How do we find ways to, collate that and allow users to when they do ask to remove their data, what data we have on them, they it's very easy for them to do that. And so that's kind of a back end thing, back office thing. Do you find that a lot of companies are actually two questions here. One, is there any regulation here when it comes to GDPR that says that, hey, we have to actually make it, even though you make it easy for them if they call up and say, hey, I want my data removed, but do they actually have to make it easy for users to actually be able to discover places for them to do it? Like, for instance, a website like Facebook, make a big green button somewhere on their Facebook page that says remove my data, or do they have to make it discoverable? Is there any regulation around that? And again, second question of that would be, if there is or if there isn't, are companies really considering that? Are they thinking about that? Are they taking that into account when it comes to this type of regulation?
Yeah, so I think the first part, there's The regulation in GDPR that you're talking about there is called a subject access request. So anyone whose data is stored, any European resident, can come along and say, tell me what data you're holding on me. And the organization then has 4 weeks in which to respond. Now, that 4 weeks can actually be extended in certain circumstances where it's a particular complex case, but essentially you've got 4 weeks to respond and to be able to provide a list of the data in a decoded form. So you can't use code 17 to say they were processed in Seattle. Okay, you've got to be able to say, it was the Seattle branch, it was this information, we're holding your name, your address, et cetera, et cetera. And to be able to provide that in a readily available form. So that's that easily discoverable piece. Now, I'm sure there are going to be organizations, Facebook being one of them, I'm sure, is going to not want to be providing that information in a physical form. They're going to be providing it all in a web form. But one of the key aspects there is you have to make sure and you have to be able to validate that the person making that subject access request has the authority to make that access and have access to the data that you're then giving to them. Otherwise, you're actually going to breach data protection regulation.
Interesting. So I guess the question would be then is there any part of GDPR that kind of adds to that says, hey, even if an organization says, hey, we offer this to users, but we don't make it easy for them. Like, for instance, they might hide, you might have to go through 10,000 prompts on the phone or, it's kind of like a deterrent for them, for people not to ask for their data to be removed,
yeah,
even though they're following regulation. Is there anything that prevents that type of behavior?
Yeah, there is. In terms of GDPR, the data subject, if they feel that their attempts to obtain their data is being obfuscated or they're being hurdles are being put in the way, or indeed if the company is refusing to provide their data in some way or provide all of the data, then they can actually make a complaint to the to their local data protection office. In the UK, that's the Information Commission Office. So they can make a complaint, and the ICO, the Data Protection Authority in the UK, will then review that complaint. They will then try and access data from that organisation. And if they're being pushed down, 10,000 key presses to actually get to the information, if they deem that to be unreasonable, then they have the option of fining the organisation and insisting that the information is made more readily available in whatever form is appropriate for that organisation.
Well, our friends in the chat room have some great questions. So Ripple Rider has a question. Do you think the UK will opt out when they leave the EU? And what's going to be the long-term effects of that?
No, I don't think they will. In fact, the UK government has already said that data privacy and data protection is one of its key aspects and that it won't be affected by Brexit. The data protection bill is working through the legal process at the moment, and that is due to be come into effect before May. And in fact, the UK bill has added an additional aspect that the TWIR audience might be interested in. A part of GDPR is the ability to anonymize data. It's called pseudo-anonymization, where effectively redact certain data so that you change, if the person's name is John Smith, you change it to John Doe. You've anonymized that data, or pseudo-anonymized some of that data. The UK government has made it part of the data protection bill that trying to undo that process, so re-identifying an individual from pseudo-anonymized data, is actually illegal and a crime in the UK, or will be once that bill is passed.
Okay, I've got another question. This is from one of our younger viewers, JJ to the 4884. He's asking, will person-to-person and cryptocurrency services be affected by GDPR?
Well, that's a good question. If they're storing personal data, that's possible from a cryptocurrency aspect. although person-to-person data isn't typically included. But if there's an organization at the back end that's defining the purpose for the collection of the data, then that organization is ultimately going to be accountable and liable under the GDPR.
Okay. This one's a question for me. I'm an academic. Everybody knows that. So what happens when I've got, say, some EU students enrolled at the University of Hawaii? What takes precedent, GDPR, or we have student privacy rules called FERPA? What kind of wrestling match do you think I might get into someday?
I think you will be. I think there will be a wrestling match. I think there's wrestling matches already with within in country. Different legislation that's sitting in place. So I think there will be wrestling matches. I guess where you've got a student who's in residence, though, in another country for a period of time, it's arguable then as to whether they are actually a resident of the European Union. If you've got someone who's on vacation, they're still a resident of the EU. So arguably at that point in time, all their addresses, all their information that they're going to be providing to you is going to evidence that they're a resident of the EU. When you've actually got a student who is then living in a country for one or two or multiple years, then they actually become more of a resident of that jurisdiction. So I think there may be some interesting aspects around that, but off the top of my head, my feeling is that that a student who's living in one location for a couple of years is probably more likely to fall under local regulation and not be falling under GDPR.
Well, we've been talking about the impact of GDPR, who's affected, who's not. So let's assume for our listeners right now that they are going to be affected by GDPR. Mm. The question then becomes, what should they be doing? I mean, as of May, they need to have done something. What should they start doing, and how frantic should they be?
Okay, so actually, we've got a slide. This part of the slide, and I'll talk to the slide, and I'll talk about how frenetic they should be. So it's actually slide number 4. So the first thing to do, for the Twire audience, where you guys are tech savvy, you're likely to be working in IT departments or heavily involved in IT. So the recommendations I would have for you guys is raise your own awareness of GDPR. Listen back to what I've said here. I've got some links. Actually, if you visit the web page at the bottom there of the slide, fifthstep.com/Twire, if you visit that web address, you'll be able to see some other links to some other information to raise your awareness. So raising your own awareness is important, because then you're able to talk about this with with the business, and you're able to help them understand exactly what their data means and where their data assets are leaving them exposed, okay? So raise your own personal awareness and help the business in that respect. I'd suggest you get a GDPR assessment. I recommend this to all organizations. It's something that can help you understand where you are today, where you need to be by May 25th, and what your roadmap is going to look like for that. If you get involved as well, third point there, get involved. If your business already has a GDPR program running, make sure they've got the right and appropriate involvement from IT. You're going to need people who know about the data assets, how the data is used, where it's transported, how it's exported, all of those kind of things. Make sure that you've got people involved in that GDPR program so that you can help the business make the right decisions and the most efficient decisions. Okay. That ties in nicely to the next point, raise the understanding of data within the business. Okay. Help them understand what data is being collected, what the personal data is. If you're collecting sensitive data like medical records, for example, you know, if they're covered by HIPAA already, you're probably doing a lot of the right things. If you're just capturing European data, then make sure that you're looking at how you're doing that. If that's something new that you're just starting to do, then you're going to need to make sure that you're doing it the right way. But help the business understand what the definitions are and the differences are between the data. And moving on to the next piece, help your business identify the changes. Okay. You're going to need to help them do that. And you're going to need to help them understand the changes, not only from a hardware and a software and a data perspective. There's also new roles that start to get introduced, like data protection officers and things like that. That may be something that your organization needs to look at and needs to understand as well. So getting the right representation from an IT perspective is really important. Now, in terms of how frenetic you need to be, you certainly need to be helping get your organization in alignment with this. At the very least, you need to know that whether you're exposed, whether you're holding this data or not. You definitely need to be on the path to compliance by May 25th. And when I say need to be on the path to, ideally you're there already, okay, by May 25th. If you've still got things to be done after May 25th, you know, many of the data protection authorities have said that it's going to be a softer landing. Okay, so that means they're not going to be as harsh on people in the first few months of actually implementing or the law coming into place. But organizations have had over 2 years to implement GDPR now. There's going to be a certain amount of patience, but not lots and lots of patience, particularly if you're based in Europe and should have been doing a lot of this stuff, for many years already. To answer your question, Kurt, does that help?
I think that gives us a lot of information on where people should be going, and we're coming down toward the end of our time. I did have one more question that had come up in a back channel chat room. We've been assuming that we're going to be do things to avoid problems, and that being in compliance with GDPR will help us avoid privacy breaches. Does GDPR contain any specifics about what must be done if a breach occurs? In other words, are there specific notification requirements in the case of a breach of sensitive or private data?
Yes, absolutely there is. And this ties into some of the existing US regulation as well. I think everyone's settled on the 72-hour period being a reasonable period of time for notification. So you have to notify the regulator of a breach within 72 hours. If it's a serious breach, then you have to notify the data subjects within that period as well, or shortly thereafter, certainly after notifying the data protection authority. So you have to be making sure that you've got a plan. This, really data breaches, and I'm sure, your listeners are going to be nodding their heads, or I hope they are, in terms of making sure you've got a plan for a data breach or a hack, however the data's actually leaving the building, make sure you've got a plan. Make sure that it covers off all of the areas. You're going to need to understand what the nature of the data is that's been lost, an estimate of how much data is being lost or taken or stolen, however it's left the building, the impact that that's likely to have on the data subject. So if you're losing bank account information and you're losing full identity information, then obviously the impact is going to be quite large, and the mitigation that you're going to be looking to put in place is going to have to be proportionate to that loss and to that impact. And you're going to need to know those three or four things before you contact the data protection authority that you need to report to. Have the plan, make sure you can follow the plan. If you need help generating a plan, then reach out to the right people to get that done. It's not something that you want to be doing as an ad hoc. On the day you find out there's a breach, You don't want to be thinking to yourself, oh, yeah, that was on our to-do list. We really should have gotten to that and written our breach plan. You want to be following your plan and running with it and adapting to it if circumstances require, but you want to have a good plan right from the outset.
And I'm going to assume that in the case of one of these breaches, that's when we start having the regulators do things like invoke some of the fines to help remind you that you really should be doing better in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a triple play phone internet and mobile phone operator here in the UK called TalkTalk, who had a breach. It must have been about 18 months ago now. They had a breach. From the outside, it looked very much like they didn't have a breach plan. They were out in the media within a very short period of time after the breach occurred. And the regulator ultimately fined them 80% of the maximum fine. Okay, now at the moment that means it's £400,000 or about $600,000 that they were fined. Under the new regulation, they would have been fined closer to about $18 million, $18 or $19 million actually. They would have been fined at that point in time if the same judgment had come down. So that's certainly the case when there's a breach, but also organizations can be fined on complaints from data subjects as well. If a data subject claims their data is being misused, then a data protection authority can get involved, investigate that. If they find and uphold that complaint, then they can fine the organization for non-compliance.
So and so in case you're talking a little bit about fines and how, you know, penalties that companies will pay, obviously you probably heard, I won't go down the rat hole of talking about Experian, but you know, there's been some breaches here that we've heard about recently. And so how would these companies be affected? Is it relative to the business that they have, to the money they make, to the amount of data they actually breach, or if they don't follow these rules around how fast they talk to their customers, let their customers know, what kind of penalty do they pay? What is it relative to?
It's relative to all of those factors, in fact, Lou. The amount of data that's lost, the ability for the organization to mitigate the risk, whether it's seen that the data was protected in an adequate way for the organization, for the nature of the data being held, how quickly they're able to respond. All of those factors that you've mentioned play a part. You know, Equifax, if it happened after GDPR, I think would have been a potentially very different story. And large organizations like that with, you know, a large turnover, they're unlikely to be having their fines capped at the 20 million euro mark. They're more likely to be falling into the 4% of annual revenue bound you know, category. And that's going to make big fines, and that's going to make big headlines, and that's going to scare a lot more people into getting their own house in order, which is very much what the European regulators are looking for.
Well, Darren, this has been an absolutely fascinating and utterly vital conversation that we've been having. I know that we have in most ways just scratched the surface of this very large and important issue. Aside from your book, which everyone should go out and get, how can people keep up with your thoughts and your writing on GDPR and its impact going forward?
Best thing to do is to follow Fifth Step. That's at Fifth Step on Twitter. You can find us also on LinkedIn. We're very prolific there. You can also visit the Fifth Step website. That's Fifth Step in words, FIFTHSTEP.com. You'll find lots of information there. We're offer a lot of information about GDPR and other topics that we cover as well. We do that as podcasts, we do that as blogs, we do that as videos. So no matter whether you prefer to read or to listen or to watch, we're trying to cover all the bases there. And there's lots and lots of information freely available there. I'd encourage anyone to drop by. Make sure that you follow us on social media. And, hey, subscribe to our podcast. Make it the next one you listen to after Twire.
Well, Darren, we very much appreciate you being with us, especially as it's getting deep into the evening, your time. I'd like to thank our guest, Darren Ray, CEO of Fifth Step, for being with us to talk about GDPR and why it's something that virtually every company in the U.S. needs to be thinking about. Well, we appreciate you spending yet another hour with us here at Twyatt. And before we go, want to get final words from my co-host. Let's start with Mr. Lou Maresca up in the Great Northwest. Lou, what do you have on tap for the coming week?
Well, I'm busy knee deep in figuring things out for and how to make office extensibility and office add-ins better. And you can always find my work for that at dev.office.com. And you know, I'm always up for feedback around my work and stuff that you've kind of encountered, whether it's Microsoft Graph or it's writing an add-in for Word, Excel, PowerPoint or whatnot. So check that out and check out some of the quick start guides there. And of course, you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. You know, feel free to reach out and throw some show questions by or some ideas for the show, and we can always pass them on to Chibert. And we love to chat there. So check it out.
Outstanding. And speaking of Chibert, Brian, we're glad that you're feeling better. So with your newfound vim, vigor, and good health, what do you have on tap?
Well, you can always find me. I'm on Twitter at ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or drop me an email at chibert@twit.tv. We've got a lot of great shows coming up. We've had to shuffle a little bit to try and accommodate our guests, but we are, if anything, flexible. So look forward to a lot of interesting stuff. We've got VMware talk coming up. We've got some folks talking about some of the new security issues. We've got lots and lots and lots of really great shows, and a lot of those shows came from you, the listener. So I strongly encourage you, join the trend. JJ to the 4884 has certainly sent me an awful lot of information. So has HiWeb and various other folks. Send me more information. I'd love to go and book a lot more of really great guests. And I should point out, thank you very much to Darren for being on the show and being here so late in London. He is actually a Twyatt listener. So thank you so very much. He was one of the people that sent an email to chibert@twit.tv. And lo and behold, you had him on the show. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to you all. As for me, well, it's great to be back on Twyatt. You can keep up with what I'm doing on Twitter at KG4GWA. Find me on LinkedIn and all the other social media as well. Look forward to hearing from you about what you'd like to hear and see on future episodes of Twyatt and with any questions you have about what you've heard on today's episode. As always, you can subscribe to Twyatt at twit.tv/Twyatt. You can watch the live show and join the chat room. We're at irc.twit.tv. It's a lively and, well, very fascinating chat room. Urge everyone to be part of that. Become a more active part of the Twyatt Riot. Well, for our guest, Darren Ray, for Brian Chi and Lou Maresca, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. And when you need to know about what's going on in enterprise technology, well, just keep Twyatt.